Yeah, what is it?
Aye, Captain. I be talking to the crew and I tells them, top men, your handling of the sheets to be lubbery and unnavy-like. Until the signal calls, you're to spill the wind from our sails. There'll be no chance for reload. So, gun captains, that gives you one shot from the larboard battery. One shot only. You'll fire for her main mast.
Look, Putterman, we've been over this. You're on a container ship, all right?
Carrying blubber whale and breadfruit to London town. Aye, sir.
No, we're carrying iPhones, flat-screen TVs, and Nike running shoes, you moron.
We'll rent and we'll roar like true ship containers. We'll rent and we'll roar on deck and below until we see bottom inside the two sunkers.
Stop! I said yesterday, no shanties.
How about grog, sir?
No grog. Look, Putterman, I get that you've watched a lot of movies, but this is totally different. We're basically in a huge building that just happens to be moving. The connection to the sea is incidental.
But there do be pirates, Captain.
Yes, maybe pirates.
And we do fight them with pistol and cutlass.
No, we go into a heavily reinforced panic room and kind of wait them out.
Would you care to hear a panic room, Chanty?
No, look, just go over there and don't say anything or do anything for the next 2,000 miles, all right? And if you get bored, you can listen to this show, which is about ships like this and also about all the things down in the ocean which you are never going to be anywhere close to. And now his fraternity name was Little Mermaid, Colin McEnroe.
Yes, we were doing a show about the sea, and we're going to look at it a couple of different ways here. A little bit later, you'll be hearing about the extreme life of the sea, the creatures that do live in the sea and live under extraordinary circumstances and with extraordinary physical burdens that they, through their biology, overcome. We'll also be talking about the garbage patch that's out there. You've probably heard about that, the plastic ocean. But before we do that, and this is sort of something that we've been talking about for, let's see, about 3 months in some ways, and it kind of started with... not the movie Captain Phillips, but the movie All Is Lost. In the movie All Is Lost, Robert Redford plays this sailor, sort of a pleasure sailor, but he's out on some long, extended ocean voyage by himself in a sailboat. And he awakens at the beginning of the movie to discover that the hull of his boat is, or the side of his boat is been pierced by one of these enormous rectangular containers that must have fallen off one of these gigantic container vessels. And now it's in the process of sinking him and killing him. And meanwhile, kind of mockingly, children's sneakers are spreading out across the ocean. That turns out to have been what is in them, and what is threatening him now with death is an enormous load of children's sneakers. And later in the movie, and this is a little bit of a spoiler, but one of these huge vessels goes by him, and he's in distress at this point. But either it can't see him, because these things are just enormous, as you'll hear, or it can't stop. And we are actually all standing in the lobby of the movie theater talking to James Hadley, who's kind of our resource about everything. And we were interested in that whole question. Well, could it stop? I mean, how many miles would it have to go before something that big could stop? Is it even allowed to stop under current anti-piracy rules and stuff like that? Even if you saw somebody floating around in a life raft and you were the captain of one of these enormous things, would you even be allowed to stop? And we suddenly realized we just didn't really know anything about all this stuff. But we very quickly, and James was the one who did it. He found this book called 90% of Everything, Inside Shipping, the invisible industry that puts clothes on your back, gas in your car, food on your plate, and really look around you right now, wherever it is that you're sitting. If you've got an iPhone, or if there's a computer monitor sitting near you, and there's clothes on your back and sneakers on your feet, and almost all of it came this way, hence the title. And the author, Rose George, is joining us right now from BBC in Leeds, Yorkshire. She's going to tell us even more about this. So first of all, welcome to our show.
Thank you.
And you decided to look into this a number of different ways, but one of the things that you did was enlist on a very, very long voyage on one of these enormous ships. Before we get to the voyage, give us a sense of the dimension of these boats. I hear 3 football fields long, which is something that would be meaningful, I guess, to us Americans. But, I mean, how big a boat is this?
Well, for a start, if you tell a seafarer that they've gone to sea on a boat, they're not going to be very happy with you, I'm afraid.
All right, so I've already made a mistake.
Yeah, it's a ship. So my ship was actually a medium-sized ship. It was it could carry 7,000 containers, and it was nearly 300 meters long. So it's about 3 to 4 soccer pitches. I'm not sure how long your football pitches are. To me, it was enormous. You know, standing on the gangway, waiting to embark, it was just the hugest thing I was ever going to encounter. But it was actually a pretty average-sized ship.
And how far did you go on this ship?
I travelled for about 9,500 nautical miles from Felixstowe in southern south coast. On the east coast of England, mm-hmm. to Singapore, through the Indian Ocean, so through pirate waters, going through the Suez Canal, sort of skirting down past India, calling at Sri Lanka, and then down the Malacca Straits into Singapore.
And what was your ship carrying?
I have no idea. Neither did anyone on board. It was carrying 7,000 containers.
Mm-hmm.
I was traveling on a ship owned by Maersk, which is the biggest container shipping line in the world. And I believe starred in All Is Lost. It was a Maersk ship, I think.
Yes.
And I did ask them, I just, as to satisfy my curiosity, I asked them to tell me what was in 12 containers. And it was mostly, 3 or 4 of them were personal effects of people obviously moving to Asia. There were some baked beans, there was some paint, there was a variety of things. I mean, what we could do, because there was no manifest on board, because if there'd been a manifest, it would have been the size of several Bibles and no one would have had time to go through it anyway. So there isn't a manifest kept on board. It's generally kept in shoreside offices. But what I did do was go through the hazardous materials, which are listed on board, so that they, if anything happens, they know how to put out fires or something. So it was quite funny to go through those and guess what was in them, because they're only listed by chemicals. So we guessed that there were airbags, so there may have been cars. We guessed that there was paint stripper. We guessed all sorts of things. So that kept us occupied for an evening or two.
Obviously, your title tells part of the story of your book, 90% of Everything. And that really is the case, right? I mean, so much of everything that touches our lives, the physical stuff of our lives, for one reason or another, have to be moved around in this manner.
Yeah, 90% of world trade travels by sea. And I think that certainly in the UK, which is, even though it's a maritime nation, and I think probably in the US, I think there's a general perception amongst the general public that probably if people think about it, then probably a lot goes by air. But in fact, the only things that go by air, because it's so expensive and because planes are so small compared to these massive ships, are mistakes and things that are urgent, and things like haute couture, which are sent by air. I think iPhones do actually go by air. I don't think they do go by ship. But otherwise, pretty much everything that we need, including oil, gas, even water, is shipped by ship. So pretty much everything is shipped by ship.
Is it? I mean, there's something fundamentally inefficient sounding about baked beans being placed in some huge cargo container and then placed on some big boat that's traveling 9,000 miles. I mean, is this a good way to move things around?
Yeah, it's extremely cheap. It's the reason that we can have globalization is because we have containerization. Because before that, if you to transport anything, it would cost you nearly a quarter of the cost of anything to get that thing that you were transporting to a port. So your profits would be eaten into immediately. Once containerization was standardized by a US shipping guy called Malcolm McLean, think of it like a Ford production line. So everything was standardized. Suddenly there was this box that could be just lifted off a ship, put onto a truck, put onto a train, bam, and off it went. So costs decreased dramatically. And suddenly, I mean, these days, depending on what the economy is doing, but there's a fact that really astonishes people that I put in the book, which is that, for example, Scottish cod is sent to China to be processed. To be filleted and then sent back and to be sold in Scottish shops. And the same thing happens to Monterey shrimp and all sorts of items. It's incredibly cheap to ship something by container.
Because of economies of scale. I mean, it seems crazy. Yeah, it seems crazy. And it seems, I mean, I guess when we say, is this a good way to do things, that's a vast philosophical conversation about whether it makes sense to make and do things close to home or whether it makes sense to lower the price of things by having the labor and the manufacturing concentrated in countries where labor is cheaper. I mean, this is just it's a conversation really about our way of life, which is supported by the industry that you're writing about.
It is. It's a conversation about globalization, about outsourcing, about labor markets. It's a conversation about everything. It's a conversation about 100% of everything. But it, I mean, shipping, it is efficient, and we would not be able, the modern economy would not be able to function without it. There's just no way.
And yeah, it's a bell that cannot be unrung. Given that it's with us and it's here to stay, it does make sense to know more about it. And it seems as though it's something that most of us, I mean, until this year, in which I watched both Captain Phillips and All Is Lost and thought a little bit more about all this stuff, I'd given this whole thing precious little thought. And I think I'm not that unusual. In fact, there's even a word for it, right? Sea blindness.
Yes, that's something that the head of the Admiralty in the UK talks about quite a lot, that we have sea blindness, that we don't really see the sea anymore. Or if we do, we just see it as somewhere to go on holiday to a beach. But generally what we do is fly over it. And because we don't travel by liner anymore, and we generally fly places if we're going any great distance. And so it's not seen as a place of industry or work. And I think it's become slightly shoved out of our minds. And I think Captain Phillips and All Is Lost have done a really good thing in bringing it back into prominence. And finally, people are thinking, goodness, you know, people are working on these ships every single day, every single night. I mean, there are 1.25 million seafarers doing their job on the most dangerous element on the planet, the most dangerous place on the planet, which is the ocean. I mean, your opening segment, which I very much like the thought of a panic room shanty, by the way. But the opening segment said, you know, the sea is very removed from these ships. But that's not true. It's not, because however safe a ship, however big they are, however safe it is, and ships are a lot safer now, you're still very, you are absolutely not secure. You can't be, because you're on the ocean and there's no unsinkable ship.
That's a great point. We're talking to Rose George right now. Her book is 90% of Everything. This is about this incredible shipping industry. Her other books, we're going to have Rose George back as soon as possible, because one of her other books is The Big Necessity, which is about basically pee and poop. And we really want to do this show. We've been looking for a way to do this show. We didn't know your book existed, so we're thrilled with that. We want to come back and talk about the world of elimination. And we'll probably do a show about whatever the next book is that you write. We'll find out about that. But right now we're talking about these container boats. So these container ships, these container vessels, they there's a lot on them, as you say, 7,000 containers, but not a lot of people, right? It doesn't take that many people to do what it has to do, which is to go from place A to place B.
No, I mean, when I got on board and I was the ship was very, people on the ship were very busy because we were in port and we had to unload containers. There was a lot going on, so. But I was just astonished by how empty the ship seemed. I was rattling around the corridors, and I just saw hardly anybody until it was dinner time. And then I found out that there were 22 people on board, and that's more than they usually are. In fact, there's something called a safe manning certificate, which is the minimum number of people on board that you should have on board, and that was 13 or 15. 15. So normally the crew would have been 19 people. Now, if you go on a warship, which I did also later on, so that was a smaller ship, it was a frigate, and there were 1,000 people on board. And if you go on a cruise ship, obviously, you know, you have 1,000 crew, and that's not even starting with the passengers. So yes, you have these enormous ships, but they're pretty lonely. Because there's hardly anyone on board.
Not many people, and one's time of service is long, right? These are long trips, and the contract you sign is for a long period of service.
If you're non-officers generally sign longer contracts than officers. So on my ship, the crew, so the non-officers, they'd usually sign 9-10 month contracts, because they had to then go back to the Philippines. They were all Filipino, and find another contract. They weren't secured to the ship. They weren't linked to the ship. They were linked to a manning agency that then they had to go and scrabble for another job. The officers, the captain was on a two-month on, two-month off contract. And the senior officers were on sort of three to four-month contracts.
You know, you mentioned the Filipino crew. This is an interesting thing about these ships, is that, you know, we think about a ship as being from somewhere. With these ships, it's an interesting and complicated question, right? The crew is often Filipino or South Asian, and the flag that it flies could be what they call a flag of convenience, which we'll get you to talk a little bit about. The ship could be owned by Americans but registered someplace else, right? I mean, these are sort of weird, a national enterprises.
Yeah, A-national, supranational, metanational, whatever we want to call them. They are extremely mobile objects. They're moving objects, but they're mobile in their identity as well. So, for example, my ship, Kendall, it did fly a British flag, which is pretty unusual, because like the US, the British fleet, the ocean-going fleet, has, on paper, has diminished dramatically since the Second World War. The US now only has 100 ocean-going vessels. But there are hundreds of American ship owners who own ships, but all their ships are flagged to Panama, Liberia, the Bahamas, all these open registries or flags of convenience. So that what that means, the reason that these flags are called flags of convenience is that they make life quite convenient for ship owners and operators. So they are allowed to employ anybody they like. So in practice, the average ship, I mean, on my ship, there were 8 or 9 nationalities, and that's pretty common. And it's quite unusual to find a totally homogenous crew on a ship with a flag that actually has anything to do with where the owner comes from.
So these A-national or pan-national ships, I mean, the other convenience is that you don't have to necessarily follow any country's set of rules. And if something goes wrong, and we're going to talk in the next segment more about environmental consequences, but if anything goes wrong, it's less clear who's going to be held accountable and by what court.
Yes, well, there is no there's no equivalent of, for example, the war crimes court. There's no equivalent for shipping crime. There's no equivalent for... it's very difficult. There is an international law of the sea, but because of the nature of ships, it can be, if the owner or anyone in the ownership structure chooses to make life difficult for investigators trying to identify them, it can be quite easy to slip away from scrutiny. And that is a problem.
Obviously, one of the issues here, and you've kind of alluded to it already, is just monotony. That to keep from going crazy, you do things like inspect the list of hazardous things on the boat and just try to find things to do. These are long trips without lots of stimulation. The other side of that, obviously, is that, as you have also said, this is not the safest place in the world to be. Things can go wrong at sea, and there really are pirates. I mean, we know from Captain Phillips, there really are pirates. How large did that particular threat loom in the minds of the people on your trip?
Well, they're a tough bunch, and I don't think they were going to admit to a woman that they were scared. But when we did reach the bottom of, we travelled a day south when we got out of the Suez Canal, and then we ended up in the Gulf of Aden, and that was called the high risk area, the danger zone. And at that point, the ship did change. It changed physically in that all the ports and windows were immediately blacked out with cardboard and blinds snapped into place. And the atmosphere changed as well. And even though they wouldn't admit to it, there was a real atmosphere of tension. And I was scared. I was honestly scared. I mean, at that point, I'd been quite cavalier about it and thinking, oh, yeah, it's fine going through pirate waters. And our ship was thought to be too big to be a threat because the side of the ship was too high for pirates to easily grapple up with a ladder. But even so, pirates evolve, and a ship was taken hostage on exactly the same route we were travelling through 24 hours earlier. So they were pretty. It was a nerve-wracking week. And when you think that seafarers were going through that every 6 weeks or so, that must put quite a lot of strain on them. Although they are a tough bunch and they're you know, hardworking guys and they're doing a good job at sea and they're proud of what they do, but I think it must have been an intolerable pressure. And I'm using the past tense because at the moment, thankfully, Somali piracy is being contained, but that's definitely not an indefinite solution.
One of the things that becomes clear is, I mean, if you were to ask me how many seafarers or anybody else were taken hostage through this process in any given year, I would pick a fairly low number. The real number, I gather, is much larger.
Well, when I went to sea in 2010, there were about 550 seafarers being held hostage, which is an astonishing number. As you say, I think most people just didn't know that. When I would ask my friends, how many hostages do you think there are? They'd say a dozen, maybe 20. But it was hundreds. And the brutality increased over the years. So let's say Somali piracy really raged for about 10 years. It's been contained for a couple of years now. But when it was really at its height, I mean, the brutality was increasing year on year. There was torture, people were beaten up. A hostage I interviewed was held, and his captain was held in the freezer for a day in his underpants. Really, really terrible conditions. So when I see pirates or piracy not really being taken seriously or just being seen as a kind of cartoon thing, particularly in relation to Somali pirates, I do get quite angry because they're criminals and they treated hostages appallingly, and their hostages had done nothing wrong. All they'd been doing was their job.
We're talking to Rose George right now. We're going to take a little break. When we come back, we're going to add a different voice to the conversation, talk a little bit about the life that's in the sea. But we also want to talk more to Rose towards the end of that segment, too, about the environmental implications of this way of moving goods around, which are substantial. All right, we'll be back.
We joined the Navy to do or die, but we didn't do and we didn't die. We were much too busy looking at the ocean and the sky, and what did we see? We saw the sea.
You know, a few years ago, we were doing a show about the search for extraterrestrial life, and we were talking to Paul Davies, who's one of the experts about this. And one of the things that he said, and it's in one of his books, is that we get very fussed up about the idea of finding extraterrestrial life, or that that we'll find, you know, even some microorganism that's not born here on Earth. And we, with good reason, we get interested in that. On the other hand, we haven't really successfully cataloged everything that's here on Earth, and that there are amazing organisms, mostly in the ocean, that we don't know about. And some of the ones that we do know about, we don't understand very well. And you got me thinking. Anyway, a good place to go if you're thinking that way is The Extreme Life of the Sea, a book by Stephen Palumbi and Anthony Palumbi. We still have Rose George. We're going to come back to her because as we go along here, after we kind of sketch out some of the extremes of life in the seas, in the oceans, we're going to talk quite a bit about what we are doing to that life and to that environment. Stephen Palumbi joins us now, though, for a discussion of these organisms, these things that live there, ranging from very small to extremely large, and a lot of them are fairly amazing. First of all, welcome to the show.
Hi, Colin. Pleasure to be here.
So your book's divided up into sections like, you know, deepest and oldest and coldest and hottest. I want to talk about hottest for a second, because that's actually one of the things I think that Paul Davies brought up, though, those many years ago, that there are life forms that are living near these vents in the ocean floor that are dispensing extreme temperatures. And these things are somehow or other choosing to live there and are able to survive in a very extreme environment. Give us a sample of one of those.
Yeah, Colin, the life down there is as you described, is almost like it's on another planet. You don't have to search hard to find something really odd and strange down there in the ocean. It's full of it. And those creatures that you were talking about live near the cracks in the seafloor where superheated water comes boiling up. And actually, it's so far down, the water doesn't boil. It can get above boiling temperatures. And there's bacteria down there that can live at 100 degrees centigrade and above. And there's some animals down there, too, that make their lives around those cracks. And one particular is a little worm. It's called a Pompeii worm. And it's only about an inch or so long. Its tail end lives at the temperature of hot tea. Mm-hmm. But its head end, an inch away, lives at the temperature of ice water, which is the normal temperature of the deep sea. So this one critter lives across a huge range in temperatures, just one inch from the head to the tail.
To what degree have we cataloged what's down there? I mean, not just in these extremely high temperatures, but were you left with the feeling that there are a lot of things that are down there that we just don't know about?
There are a lot of things down there that we just don't know about. Our book actually has an easier job because what we've been able to do is take the things that we do know about and show how amazing they are and how they manage to thrive, even under circumstances which we would find to be totally difficult to live in environmentally.
They are amazing things, but most of them live within kind of a delicate balance, too. I mean, even think about that worm. You know, it's not very big. One part of it's exposed to extreme heat, the other to extreme cold. We're not mucking around too much with the circumstances way down there, but we are mucking around a lot with our environment right now. Part of your book is devoted to bioluminescence, and right now in Puerto Rico, they've had some problems with these bioluminescent bays where they've had blackouts, and they're not even 100% sure they know why that's happening. So we're going to talk as we go along here about that delicate balance for a lot of that life. But while we're on the subject of bioluminescence, I guess I didn't, although I've been to the bays in Puerto Rico, I don't think I quite understood how remarkable this is. And there, some of these, at least one of the fish or one of the organisms that you wrote about is able to generate a kind of red light that it also can see. It actually sort of creates its own version of night vision, right?
Ah, that's exactly right, because the deep sea is dark. There's very little light down there. The light that is what you refer to, bioluminescence. But most bioluminescence, almost all of it, is blue and green in color. So if you're down in the deep sea, there's flashes of blue and green all over the place, and organisms down there are tuned to be able to see that. The trouble is if you want to see to find your prey and you flash out a bunch of light in order to find prey, well, all your predators can see that too, and they come swarming in to attack you. So the night vision strategy is something that a fish called the stoplight loose jaw has evolved. And they beam out red searchlights from the base of their cheek, right under their eyes, a little searchlight on either side. It beams out red light that they can basically find their prey with. No other fish can see that red light, but their eyes have adaptations, a couple of mutations in the gene called opsin that makes their eyes be able to see. That means that they can uniquely see the red light that they use.
And we're just skipping around here and fast forwarding through a lot of stuff. This book covers all kinds of fascinating things. But we actually did a show about seahorses a few years ago, which I dimly remember. And one of the things I became vaguely aware of is that seahorses violate a lot of basic laws, at least what we think of are basic laws of biology, especially reproductive biology. In your book, I got an education about the clownfish, which I guess is the fish in Little Nemo. But there's stuff they don't tell you in Finding Nemo. Including the fact that all clownfish are born male and then they just start to change?
No, that's right, Colin. That's what they do. And there's reasons why Disney didn't cover that part of the topic. But that's what clownfish do. In an anemone that clownfish live in, the biggest fish in the anemone is a female, and she lays all the eggs. The next biggest fish is a male, and he fertilizes all the eggs, and if the big female gets picked off by a predator, or a over-inquisitive hypothesis-testing marine biologist, then the next largest fish, the male, will grow a little bit and turn into a female, and then the next fish down in size, a smaller male, grows a little bit and becomes the male that fertilizes the egg. So there's always a pair in the anemone. They're always making eggs and fertilizing them. But who's the male and who's the female depends on their position in this size rank.
When Stephen Palumbi says grows a little bit, in the case of the male, the thing that the fish that gets designated suddenly to become the fertilizing male basically grows testes in a short period of time. I guess that's the thing you thought Disney, although it would be great animation to show that, maybe one of the things Disney didn't want to get into.
Well, that's right, and so you know, in that particular case, the father in Finding Nemo wouldn't have gone off in search of anybody. The other little fish, Nemo himself, wouldn't have gone off. In fact, they'd have just stayed in the anemone, and father would have grown a little bit and turned into the female of the house.
You know, as we go along here, I'm going to bring Rose George back into the conversation. But in a way, one of the things that links your two books is this notion of sea blindness or ocean blindness, that we don't really know that much about an ocean that we, on the other hand, feel very free to exploit. And this was really driven home to me in the chapter that you wrote about the age of things. So they find this 100-year-old harpoon in a newly killed bowhead whale in the 1990s, and suddenly realize that maybe these whales are a lot older than anybody thought. But even more chillingly, a fish that I think is actually being fished right now for consumption, this rockfish, turns out to have just a life cycle that was completely unanticipated by people, and something that we started to fish for without even remotely understanding how it lives and how long it lives.
That's exactly right, Colin. The fish that we talk about is called a rockfish, a deep sea fish off the coast of California here. And much to everyone's surprise, when they finally figured out how to tell the age of these fish, then they discovered that a fish maybe only 2 feet long was 100 years old or 120 years old. If you've got that kind of amazing creature and you're trying to fish it, well, it takes a long time to replace that 2-foot fish. So the amount of fishing pressure that they can withstand in order to be sort of a sustainable hunted population is a lot less than anybody thought.
I want to bring Rose George back into the conversation here, because now I think it is sort of time to talk about the kind of pressure that we put on some of this amazing sea life. Rose George, I know one thing that you got interested in on these vast container ships is acoustic pollution. We're going to talk about other kinds of pollution, but let's talk about noise, because I think it's also something Stephen Palumbi is interested in as well. What did you learn about the noise these enormous machines make?
Well, I didn't actually think about that when I was on board the ship. It was only later when I read a book called The Urban Whale, which I highly recommend. I think it's gripping. Which is about the North Atlantic right whale, which is one of the most endangered creatures in the world. And I started reading about this, and after that I went to Cape Cod, to Provincetown, and I hung out with some researchers who are looking into acoustic pollution. And I learned that ship propellers are not good news for ocean creatures. And as Stephen mentioned earlier, there's no light. I think it's beyond 200 meters, he may correct me, when you go underwater. So animals, creatures in the ocean often communicate by sound. And the trouble with ship propellers and the trouble with some whales, for example, is that they often are on the same frequency or similar frequencies. So we're now in a situation where I think some humpback whales, their acoustic habitat has been reduced dramatically and alarmingly, sometimes by up to 90%. And there's a lot of really interesting research being done into what kind of stresses this noise pollution underwater is putting on a very, very vulnerable population such as that of the North Atlantic right whale, which is already isn't breeding enough. So I was looking into that, and it's not very good news.
Stephen Palumbi, did you want to amplify? I guess that's a bad word to use. That whole question.
Sure. First, Rose, it's a pleasure to speak with you.
Likewise.
And I just like to mention that when you're sailing on the top of the ocean, whether it's a container ship or a sailboat or whatever, the majesty of the ocean all around is just incredible. And when you're looking out at the ocean, looking a little bit deeper and seeing the creatures that actually inhabit it, it just is mind-numbingly amazing the kinds of ways they live their lives. And what Rose is saying is absolutely true. The acoustic world of whales has shrunk down enormously. But just try to imagine what it was like before all those propellers. Here, whales moving up and down the coast, they're migrating with their relatives, and they can hear one another for not just a mile or two, but 10 miles, and up to tens or hundreds of miles. So normally, when a whale would be migrating, it would have a sonic map in its head of who was around it at all times. And then with noise pollution, they can't hear it anymore. It would be like driving along the highway with a sack over your head. You just cannot understand what your environment is like you used to.
Stephen Blumey, one of the things that comes out in your book is this delicate balance of highly interactive organisms. You can pick your favorite example. I mean, but whether it's scallops on the Carolina coast or otters on the other coast, you mess with one group, with one biological organism, you affect this incredible chain of life that we sort of know is there but don't quite understand until we begin to fiddle with it.
Yeah, and that chain of life is exactly the right way to put it. And when we fish enormously hard on one or two things, what we tend to do is break that chain of life. And by breaking that chain of life, you sort of change how the ocean functions as an ecosystem. It isn't that we can't fish, because we can. We just cannot overfish and break those chains. One of the sort of examples that we use in the book is the strange tale of shark finning all around the world, taking out the sharks in and off the coast of North Carolina. Well, those sharks normally ate skates that lived in the bays there. And without the sharks, the skate populations shot up. Well, what do skates eat? Skates eat scallops. And with a huge skate population, then the scallop population declined. So the chain of life was scallops eaten by skates, eaten by sharks. And by taking out the sharks, the secondary effect was the scallop fishing in North Carolina collapsed for years and years.
There's another chain. Of course, it's the chain of things that we do that have effects. And obviously, we're very aware of climate change right now. And Stephen Blumey has been looking a lot at what happens to coral off the coast of American Samoa when you add 1 or 2 degrees to that system. But Rose George, I want to go to you on this first, because one of the other things that we haven't said about these enormous vessels is that they, although they're a very efficient way to move goods around, they really pollute a lot, really a lot. What was the I think you cite an equivalence between them and X number of cars, but I can't remember what the equivalence was.
Well, there was a calculation done a couple of years ago which said that the 15 largest ships were equivalent to the pollution of all the cars in the world. I think that's out of date now because the largest ships now, these things called triple E's, which carry 18,000 boxes or containers, they are much more efficient. So that would have to be looked at. But certainly, if you look at shipping, although it is the most environmentally friendly method of mass transport compared to aviation or trucking by far, by a very, very long way, the trouble is that there's so much shipping, there's 100,000 vessels on the sea, that they still, it's not benign. It's still contributing up to 4% of global emissions, which is on a par with aviation. It's also on a par with somewhere near Germany. Mm-hmm. If you put countries together on a list of emitting countries. So it's something that needs to be addressed. And the good news is that it is being talked about a lot now in shipping. But the problem is that most ships on the high seas use something called bunker fuel, which was described to me by someone in the tanker industry as the dregs of the refinery. So it's really, really, really polluting stuff. I mean, if you solidified it, you could easily walk on it. Mm. And they do that because it's cheap. And even though fuel is very expensive these days, it's still the cheapest expensive fuel you can get. And so if shipping is going to have to confront looking for an alternative, looking for something with less sulfur content, with fewer dangerous particles and particulates, then it's a huge question. It's really occupying the minds of everybody in the shipping industry at the moment.
All right, we're going to grab a quick break here. Stephen Blumey, his book is just absolutely amazing, and we just scratched the surface of what's down there. If you think giant squids are interesting, and they're in there, read the book. You're going to find all kinds of things that you didn't know existed. But we have to move on. We're going to keep Rose George with us. We'll come back after this.
In an octopus's garden, in the shade, we would be warm below the storm in our little hideaway beneath the waves.
Mm-hmm. All of them are born male. The largest and most dominant male turns into a female. The next largest develops testes and fertilizes the eggs laid by the female. If the female dies, the fertile male who is number two takes her place, metamorphosing into a female. Huh. The Kardashians are so weird. Today's show was produced by Betsy Kaplan and me. Our interns are Anna Novak and Tess Aronson. The part of Bill Curry was played by Marlon Brando. Greg Hill appeared in the intro and tweets for us at WNPR Colin. Katie Tilarski is our executive producer. For show pages, articles, and audio of the Faith Middleton Show staff singing What Shall We Do with the Sailor Who's Had Five Fresh Cranberry Ginger Vanilla Margaritas, visit our website, WNPR.org. On tomorrow's show, a New Yorker cartoon show that's very different from the five other New Yorker cartoon shows being aired this week. And now, back to Colin.
Let me squeeze in one more announcement because I have to keep reminding you. On April 9th, which is a Wednesday, we'll be at Watkinson School at 7 p.m. for a show called Whatever Happened to the Field of Dreams, or How Do We Get Back to the Field of Dreams, or something like that. It's about sort of the way that greed, hyper-competitiveness, aggression, violence at the top levels of sports filters down into the sports that we play, the sports that our children play. We're going to be looking at both what happens at the very top of that pyramid, but also what happens at the base, where most of us live. Jeff Jacobs, the wonderful sports columnist for the Hartford Current, will be with us, as will Coach Reggie Hatchett, who's led Weaver to an amazing season this year in basketball, also runs a youth basketball program. We'll be talking to a longtime youth coach, youth soccer coach, whose daughter sustained a serious injury while playing youth sports, but he's still coaching. We have an amazing panel, also somebody from the Corey Stringer Institute, which does research into sports injuries and deaths from sports. So it's open to you. We'd love for you to come. I think you have to call Watkinson School or go to Watkinson.org and order your ticket. We'll be also turning it into some kind of radio show that night, so you'll be able to see our wonderful team here at work. Do join us for that at Watkinson, and go on their website and find out more about it. All right. Right now we're talking about the sea, the ocean. This is was Betsy Kaplan's idea, and it's turned out to be a very, very interesting idea. Rose George is with us. She's a journalist and the author of several books, including The Big Necessity. We will be doing an entire show about that at some point, assuming she's willing to come back. 90% of everything inside shipping, the invisible industry that puts clothes on your back, gas in your car, food on your plate. We're also going to talk right now, and this will sort of fit very well into some of the things that Rose writes about. Well, we're going to talk to Charles Moore. He's captain of the Oceanographic Research Vessel Alguita, the founder of – actually, you say it. I'm pronouncing it the wrong way, aren't I?
Yeah. The Spanish for kelp is alga, and we're a little kelp plant. We're Alguita, and our – Research Foundation is Algolita.
All right. And he's the author of Plastic Ocean. So this is about this enormous garbage patch that exists out in the ocean. It's probably somewhere located in people's minds a little bit. But Charles Moore, give us a sense of the size of this thing.
Well, you can get a sense of it if you've been following the news by thinking about one of the other garbage patches on Earth, which is in the Indian Ocean, which is confounding the search for the missing aircraft. These things are so huge that you can't really describe them as a patch. The garbage patch is a valuable moniker when, you know, getting people to think about a place, but in the ocean, you know, it's so much larger than any conceivable patch of anything that it really doesn't apply. This is millions of square miles, and it's got an average of, say, 800,000 small pieces of plastic per square kilometer and maybe one or two larger objects per square kilometer. So when you're looking for something specific, it's very, very difficult.
Rose George, you're familiar with this, and I'm wondering if we know how many containers or how often containers fall off boats and contribute to this problem. I'm assuming it didn't just happen to Robert Redford with the box full of children's shoes.
We don't know. There are figures. There is a figure that people use quite commonly, which is 10,000 containers fall off every year, which is, to me, suspiciously rounded as a figure. The World Shipping Council says it's about 300 every year, but we don't know. But if you talk to yachters or leisure sailors, people, you know, the real day Robert Redfords, they'll quite commonly have come across containers or seen them. And they are, I mean, they do contribute. They can break open when they sink, but they're also a hazard to yachts and boats because they tend to float just underneath the surface of the water, so you can't often see them. But yeah, they're a mystery. It's a mystery how many fall off.
Charles Moore, do we know where most of this plastic comes from? Does it come from cruise ships? Does it get washed into the sea from our own garbage stream? What's in these enormous patches?
There are no guiltless parties in the pollution of the ocean by our persistent waste, which is largely plastic. Everyone contributes to it because even the smallest fibers from our garments contribute to it. When you wash a polyester garment, thousands of fibers from that garment, which are persistent plastics, go out in the rinse water. So they're found in invertebrates throughout the globe. So we're all polluting the ocean. Larger objects typically come from fisheries and aquaculture operations, but also from tsunamis and storms that break coastal structures apart and send them out into these highways that lead to these gyres that accumulate the debris.
Now, these gyres are not merely eyesores. They're serious problems biologically, right? They cause ill health, malnutrition, and death, I'm assuming, to the sea creatures who are out there.
The plastic that's floating in the ocean is not simply innocently floating around. It's sponging up all of our industrial pollutants that have an oily aspect to them because it's lipophilic, oil-loving. Plastic is an open polymer matrix that's, as a matter of fact, if you have an oil spill, you use a polypropylene or a polyethylene rag to mop up the oil. It separates oil from water. It'll preferentially suck up oil and leave the water. So plastics are used to clean up oil spills, but in a passive sense, they're cleaning up the ocean of its pollutant load, but thereby transferring into the food web, because all these plastics break down through photodegradation into bite-sized bits, and there's no trophic level, meaning any feeding chain that has not now been documented to be consuming these polluted, what I call poison pills.
And obviously that stuff also comes back to us as food too. Not that we don't deserve it, but it does. Rose George, as we're talking about all this, I mean, the irony obviously here is that a lot of the stuff that winds up in these gyres is stuff that was shipped to us in boats in the first place, and we turned it in one way or another into waste, and it gets back in the ocean that way. As you looked at this, talk about a chain, talk about a web, as you just looked at this web of material, is it some kind of powerful argument for a more sustainable lifestyle, for less stuff and stuff that's maybe produced a little closer to home?
Yeah, totally. Yes, it absolutely is. We definitely have to confront the stuff, just the mountains and mountains of stuff that we have to make a difference between need and require and want. We have to question exactly, traveling on a container ship, it's ironic that when you're out at sea on the ocean. I mean, I absolutely loved being on my ship. I loved going out on deck and just being there in the middle of all that immensity. But it's an isolating place, but you are actually surrounded in all those boxes by immense amounts of stuff, and you start to question, because you can't get access to any of it. You can't go shopping. You can't, on a ship, you can't even get television. You can't have the internet. You can't phone home, not easily. And you're actually more removed from modern society and all its trappings than ever before. So ironically, although you're surrounded by it in all those containers, you start to question of how much of it you actually need, how much you miss. And the answer, my answer is not very much.
All right, that's Rose George. Her book is 90% of Everything. Charles Moore, his book is Plastic Ocean. Charles Moore, I've only got 30 seconds, but in 30 seconds, I give you the power to change one thing that might ameliorate this problem. What would you change in 30 seconds?
I'd change the economic paradigm that we live under. The 11th commandment is not thou shalt grow the economy, but it's taken as such. No politician can be elected on a slow growth or no growth platform. So until we have a steady state economy that has fair distribution of resources and, as the previous speaker said, rational distribution of resources based on true needs, We haven't got a chance to solve this problem.
All right. Charles Moore, thanks so much. Thanks also to Rose George. She'll be back, assuming we didn't scare her away, at some point to do a whole show about the big necessity, which is what comes out of you.
It's paradise, just you and me.
And me and the sea.
Just you.
Just you.
And me.
And me and the sea.
Why are fish so smart?
Craig, I don't care.
Because they're always in schools.
Ugh.
How do you tune a fish?
What does that even mean?
With a sea scale.
Oh, God, I hate you.
I went to a sea turtles party last night. Had a shell of a good time.
Okay, show's over.